destroy the documents. And the legal implications of that.
Who's in our group exactly?
Okay.
We don't have a.
Test 1, 2, 3. 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 God, I lost something that I worked on this morning. It kills me. Say it again. Why don't we just say
you will hear at the end of this case from the government.
Introduce yourself. We'll be with you at 12:30. I managed to do that.
Does the evidence to show?
They've all been emailed?
Yes.
And they know what they're doing?
I'm really logging out.
Is there a friend from here in there? Oh, there he is. Good.
All right, so here's this display. That looks familiar.
Okay, yeah.
Can I turn on your external display?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Great. Do you need the scroll mouse again?
Can I get it so I have it on both here? No, I don't.
Do you want to put it in a mode that has bigger font?
I'll work with it for a bit until I get it. Who's this?
Yeah. Have you been seen?
Have you seen?
Good.
I'm going to change the Georgia slash Nick or change the.
Yeah. I don't know.
I've
Ben or
login. Yeah.
How
do you change your login?
Make sure you log in with the right number, yeah? Are we going to close that door?
Yep. Yep, we're going to close it.
So one person's already logged on. Oh, Matt, you're on screen.
Yeah.
You can tell when you're on screen.
Oh.
Take up a seat somewhere, Tim, so you're comfortable. No.
No one to talk with, all by myself. No one to walk with, but I'm at the on the shelf. Misbehaving, praising my love for you, for you, for you, for you. I know I'm certain the one I love. I'm through with flirting, it's you that I'm thinking of. And misbehaving, praising my love for you. Like Jack Horner in the corner, don't go nowhere. What do I care? Your kisses are worth waiting for.
Can you bring me so I'm not going off the top?
Out late, no place to go. I'm on the crowding, just me and my radio. They misbehaving, saving all my love for you.
It's 12:30, right on the nose.
James got half of Jim Siegel, whose number is just forwarded to you.
Can't
go on chat.
Okay.
James.
I think he just got a message.
I'm going to be replied to you.
Sure, keep going. What was the problem?
There's an extra O in all of the chat. What about DBO1? Does anyone have DBO1? No DBOO?
Four.
So one is the one we're not using. Becca, is that consistent with reality? Pin mod 6 equals 1 is never the case. You said there were 5 moderators.
Mm-hmm.
0 for 5 is 6 numbers. 0, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. So there must be some number through 6 that you didn't assign. So do you want to start? Or?
Mm-hmm.
I need to get the login going here. Can get a little bit out of your way if you like. What are some 10 numbers that you wouldn't have given out?
Only give out 1 10 to 1 14.
Okay. 10, 11, 12, 13, 14.
Good.
Yeah, that's exactly what I was saying.
Oh, Paul T., I was unable to check in on Friday, and I'm now getting the same error message on the video.
well, welcome
to part two of the online portion of Digital Discovery. We are making a few small changes this time and hope things go smoothly. Just at the outset here, let me say that one of our little changes is that we will be leaving a microphone open during the entire session so that you will have the sense of a continuing webcast, even though I won't be speaking to you constantly through the session. My intention here is to review some of the questions that we dealt with last week and to invite some further discussion of them, and then to go on to new matters this week. While we're just getting started and actually waiting for a few others to join, may I invite you all to go to your discussion groups. I believe you may already be there, and just spend a few minutes reintroducing yourselves. There are some different groupings and so different people for you to meet. So let me excuse myself at this point, and I'll be back in just a few minutes, and we'll be started once again. Thank you. So can I say hello to people in each of these groups? So let's review a little bit of
last week, both on the web forums and in the online discussion that we were able to conduct. I was pleased to respond to a number of wonderful comments and enjoyed, in effect, meeting some of you during the week by email. And there are some issues that I'd love to see us pursue even further today. First, let me say a word about preservation and preservation orders. It's clear, reading the flow of responses from you, that plaintiffs regard the preservation order as a very positive element, something that allows them to put the defendants on notice. And even though it, as an order, doesn't really extend the reach of the common law obligations, it identifies the responsibility of the defendant and gives the sense of increasing the chance of sanction should the defendant, the respondent, the producer of information, somehow default in the course of their discovery effort. And as such, it improves the negotiating position. A number of people on the plaintiff's side indicated that to them, discovery is primarily a negotiation, and anything that improves the negotiating position increases the likelihood that they will actually be successful. So from the plaintiff's side, the preservation order is a delightful instrument, and they are pleased to find that judges, in fact, are quite willing to grant them. The picture is totally different on the defense side. From the defendant's point of view, their major problem is that the judges to whom these requests for preservation orders are addressed seem not to understand either the technology or the tactic. At the technology level, defense lawyers and corporate counsel in effect complain that judges don't appreciate the complexity of the technological environment within the corporation, not understanding the widely distributed nature of the technology, the tremendous differences in type, the tremendous numbers of people, and geographic distribution of people who are often required to respond to a preservation order if it's to be done in a serious fashion. The defense and corporate counsel also points to the overbreadth of these discovery orders, preservation orders. These are orders entered at the very outset of litigation. They come before the plaintiffs have any real idea of specificity or ability to delineate their request in detailed form. And so the kind of preservation order that we saw in Linen is fairly typical, requesting all evidence relevant with no real specification as to people, names of people who are relevant, date frames which would limit the extent of the preservation responsibility, data types which would greatly limit the kinds of information that are sought, and specific departments or parts of the responding producing entity that would constrain the reach. And so there is a tremendous burden of uncertainty that falls on the producing party as a result of the preservation order, with wide questions of scope and who the relevant agents are who have to respond. The defense side of this issue is also plagued by what I think of as the rhetorical dimension of this particular issue. Judges, many feel, are to a significant extent defense-oriented, many having come from the defense bar, more from the defense bar than from the plaintiff's side. At least that's the feeling. And that being the case, there is some sense on the plaintiff's side that judges are not typically wide open to discovery requests. In fact, can often be very hesitant to issue wide orders. And yet, when it comes to preservation, there's a certain rhetorical dimension that enables judges, makes judges feel more comfortable in issuing the orders. After all, preservation seems not to be an aggressive thing. It doesn't seem to require responding producing entities to do anything but stop destroying things. And so a relatively easy order to make. One of the responses to this problem is that while it may be true that the burden of uncertainty falls in a major way on the producing party, there is an offsetting benefit that by placing this burden on the producing party, it forces the producing party to come into court to seek clarification of the order, and by that process, actually serving to delineate the reach of the order in much more specific terms. If this, in fact, worked, it would be quite a useful form of solution to the problem. That is, the plaintiff opens with the request for preservation order. It may be overbroad, it may create a burden of uncertainty, but if it's possible for the defendant to come into court and effectively request a narrowing and delineation, then the responsibilities become more defined. The problem from the defense point of view, however, is once again, they're feeling that judges are not up to the tech or the tactic. They're not as aware as they could be and as sensitive as they could be to the needs for confining the preservation order, and they're not as aware as they might be of the usefulness to plaintiffs of a tactic of putting defendants on the defensive with these preservation orders in hopes that, in fact, the result will be some sort of screw-up later on down the line that will increase the leverage of the plaintiff's lawyers. And so that results in a strategy of response on the defense side, which takes two forms. One possible form is to seek a change in rules. There have been some rule changes, very few. Texas, I'll mention in further in a moment, has actually established a limitation on the scope of discovery, which would seem to throw the burden to the plaintiffs to be more specific if they want greater specificity in preservation. But the fact is that the suggestions for rule changes have not really taken root, with most responding that the existing rule structures are adequate. Nonetheless, there are suggestions that Rule 34 should be changed so as to state that parties should not be required, are not required, to suspend the normal operation of reasonable document destruction without specific prior orders to do so from the court, and with the further additional statement that spoliation sanctions will only apply to willful violations of such orders. We'll look at spoliation later in the session. If it's the case that rules changes are not likely to be a successful meta-strategy for the defense bar, then the next line of attack is one of educating judges. The idea is if judges need to get up to speed on tactics and tech, then somehow there should be undertaken an education program that is capable of doing that. Now, of course, I believe it's true that in order to succeed with such an education program, there's nothing much better than a specific proposal to change rules as a focal point for discussion. And if the result of a strategy of rule change is, if not immediate success in the form of actual rule changes, but rather a growing and informed consensus that rule change is not needed because there's already sufficient flexibility, then it's the benefit that follows from just that process that leaves you with a bench as well as a bar that is much more attuned to the preservation problem. So, to me, those are the issues that jumped out of our discussion on preservation that are interesting. One issue that I would love to see you address to some extent in the discussion group is that from the defense side, the assumption in large part is that the plaintiff's bar doesn't seek preservation solely for the sake of obtaining documents, but rather seeks the preservation order in what is almost a bad faith form of assault. That is, the purpose is not the merits of the lawsuit, but actually the hope of generating a side issue on which they can put the defendants in a bad light simply by reason of the fact that many companies are insufficiently in command of their information environments to respond with complete 100% completeness to the dictates of the preservation order. So I would be really interested in seeing an exchange on just that question. That is this in fact a field that is riven with bad faith, or are we dealing instead, by and large, with what one might think of as a generation gap, a period of time in which people unfamiliar with technology are doing their best, but not necessarily doing very well with the subject at hand. So with that, let me ask you to go to your discussion groups for a few minutes, and then we'll be back. Thank you. Thank you.
Sounds like baby pattern. Baby elephant pattern, that's what I call it. Say, up in Harlem, at a table for two, there were four of us, me, your big feet, and you. From your ankle up, I'll say you sure are sweet. From that down, there's just too much feet. Yes, your feet too big. Don't want you because your feet's too big. Can't use you because your feet's too big. I really hate you because your feet's too big. Yeah. I did all that.
During the course of this last week, the rules clearly give the courts the ability to respond to undue burdens of discovery by limiting scope and shifting costs. And that is indeed the general rule. But the reality seems to be that it's a rule that has gone substantially underutilized or significantly underutilized. Yet in our discussion, I found that there was a remarkable consensus during the week to the idea that some balancing of costs, some potential shifting of costs, is a reasonable and oftentimes a good idea. And a consensus that was by no means limited to the producing side. A number of the people working on the plaintiff side basically took what I would call a strategy of reasonableness. The basic orientation was one in which the plaintiff's expectation going into discovery is by no means one of absolute responsiveness on the part of the judge, but rather one in which the plaintiff's attorney feels the necessity for establishing a reasonable position. That is, a stance in which the plaintiff's attorney appears open to the idea of limitation and focused on the idea of getting just what the plaintiff needs. And so the initial opening in discovery, which may be very broad, could be narrowed down by specification of the people to be followed in the search process, the specific subject matters to be searched for, the dates within which search could be limited, and to an extent the data types which needed to be searched, even to the point where plaintiffs were willing to suggest specific search terms that could be used in the course of litigation. This was seen as a strategy for getting something, and not just something, but the most valuable elements of discovery, and fending off the risk that by seeming to ask for everything, plaintiff's lawyers would wind up with much less than they might otherwise get. On the specific subjects of types of data, the issue of deleted email produced a very interesting exchange. There was no lawyer who was prepared to contend that deleted email was beyond the scope of discovery. And indeed, those courts that have looked at the issue have been uniform in saying that deleted email, even though the user might have thought it was gone, if capable of recovery, is within the scope of discovery. On the other hand, deleted email was a subject that presented a cost issue, and insofar as it presents a cost issue, presents the possibility of discovery limitation. To the extent that deleted email is more expensive to get at than active data, requiring attempts at recovery, then the question arises, is the additional cost of recovering deleted email warranted? And therefore, makes possible the argument that there should be some showing before a producing party is required to recover and produce deleted email. That is, some reason to expect that deleted email will be of some particular use, or some reason to think that the producing party has been disposing of relevant and useful email. In this fashion, the subject of deleted email becomes a live issue, not in terms of theoretical scope of the discovery rules, but at least as a potential line that a judge might draw in the course of saying what the reach of discovery should be, and conceivably what the reach of the cost obligation of the producing party should be. A second line that was offered was that of the Texas rule, the limitation to active data, data which is available in the ordinary course of business. This, of course, is the ideal position of the corporate producer of information. The corporation would like to be able to maintain active data according to the needs of its business and to respond to discovery within the realm of that active data without having the necessity to go to residual data, inactive data, and more expensive forms in order to make recovery. It's the case that the Texas rule has been adopted, and people are interested to see how it is actually working in practice. At the same time, as mentioned, there seems no rush to be adopting this rule elsewhere. And I have to say, the limitation to active data seems quite constrained. That is to say, there is no particular reason why a plaintiff dealing with some event that occurred in years past, possibly considerable years past, should be constrained in discovery to just that data which is of current use to the business. There is the argument that is possibly the essence of the active data issue, and that is whether plaintiffs should bear some cost of searching so-called inactive data. Two issues arose with respect to inactive data, which I found very interesting. First, there was the suggestion in my questions to you of staged approaches to the searching of inactive data, the possibility of searching in time periods that are not exhaustive of every single backup tape, but that deal with overlapping information in backup tapes in a way that creates stages of approach, and at a point where it appears that no truly valuable information is being produced by further search, at that point either the search stops or the burden of searching in terms of cost would shift. As I said at the outset, there was remarkable consensus that that form of approach was legit. Plaintiffs were prepared to accept it as well as defendants to assert it. And given the basic problem for judges, which I believe to be where does one find a line to draw, this formulation of staged approach, although it's the burden of the producing party to do it, would seem to be potentially very productive. However, a second quite interesting question arose from one of our participants with respect to the staged approach. The premise of such an approach is that inactive data is significantly more expensive to search than active data. And just as with deleted data, creates a cost differential that needs to be justified if the producing party is to be made to pay it. One of our participants, Jeff Landino from OnTrack, had a very different take on it. In his response to the question, he said, "I would first get a new discovery consultant." That is, one different from the one who was asserting the differential in costs. Active versus inactive data searching, he says, is no different time and cost-wise, so long as your expert has the available storage space to house the data for searching, and I may say the available software for searching it. For the majority of engagements Landino had seen, searching backups was the most common process of discovery. And so a question that I would love to see you address in the discussion groups is it the case that as technology is progressing, the actual costs of searching backup data will be dropping? That is, as the capacity for doing it expands, the cost of doing it will drop. And as the cost of doing it drops, this whole argument for a staged searching process will diminish to some considerable extent. I had one more observation that I wanted to bring to your attention. This came from Alex McDonald. Alex McDonald is the lawyer, the plaintiff's lawyer, in the Linen case, and he continues to be active in the multi-district litigation around Fen-Phen. His comment was this. He said, having litigated the issue in Linen, I remain startled by the extraordinary gap that exists between the policies, protocols, and promises set forth in document retention policy manuals of major corporations, and how poorly those manuals are complied with in the real world. So Alex identifies a tremendous gap between the promise and the reality that corporate retention policies seem to offer. He goes further. He says the gap issue has become so significant that it is my and other mass tort lawyers' practice in new pharmaceutical and other cases to mark up as the first wave of corporate depositions the deposition of individuals who are in the employ of the defendant most knowledgeable regarding the document retention policy manual, its composition, its updating, and its enforcement. Finally, Myron Eagle from Evidence Exchange offers this. He says, in complete support of McDonald's observation, it's almost always worth taking 30B6 depositions of records custodians of both electronic data and paper data. His reason? That you will learn about the retention policy and, having learned about it, be in a better position to negotiate discovery practice for the rest of the case. So I'm interested in these questions in the discussion group. First, very interested in Jeff Lendino's question. That is the technology changing the pricing structure? The pricing structure being the thing that drives the urge for cost shifting, at least in a theoretical way. Is the technology changing the price structure in a way that may, in fact, in some degree evaporate this problem? And second, very interested in the gap that Alex McDonald describes. Does it exist? And if it does exist, what vulnerabilities does it create for the corporation? What opportunities does it create for the plaintiff's lawyer? So if you would now, return again to the discussion groups. I have a feeling that you're already there. And let me hear from you. Thank you. What response have you gotten to Jeff's point? Our price structure does not reflect the difference for active data versus archive.
Would it impress you? Would it distress you? Good. Well, that's a those nights you say for you. I yearn. Yeah, I yearn. Sure I do. Would you think I'm speaking out of turn? No, I'm not lying. This fella's lying. Yeah. Those nights declare. Would you take my love and share it with me? I'm not supposed to. I'm in love with you. Come on, hold it, baby. Yeah.
So how are we doing? Are these conversations? No, I don't.
I'll join back out again. But look at this! Do the back of town! My. Yes, yes, yes.
So let me draw you away from your discussion groups once again. Some very interesting points have come up in the discussions. One response to the Landino question that was interesting to me was that, in a sense, there's a problem of proportion. That while it's true that costs of processing inactive data are dropping, the amount of data that needs to be processed seems to be rising. And so the problem, in some sense, is a wash. And then we actually had just flat-out disagreements. Jim Michalowicz from DuPont was clear and ready to supply numbers on how expensive it is to search a backup tape, putting the major cost on the problem that backup tapes are not indexed, not particularly on the problem of remounting them, which can be difficult, but the problem of actually having to go through them and order them in some way that allows them to be effectively searched. On the other hand, others have maintained that no, the costs with respect to inactive data and active data are more or less the same. So this continues to be an interesting empirical issue. I, at this point, would like to turn to the question of process. We put out the process question during the week and got back a number of really, in their way, fascinating responses. at the core of the process issues is the question of whether it's possible for the participants in the discovery process to take advantage in some significant way of the efficiencies that the digital process potentially offers. A comment back from Larry Johnson at FEOS I thought was particularly pointed in this respect. Larry wrote me, "I'm enough of a techno-enthusiast to believe that electronic discovery will do much to promote the goals of Federal Rules of Civil Procedure number 1, the just, speedy, and inexpensive determination of every action. An interesting study in point, one I'm sure you're familiar with, Price Waterhouse conducted a study in which a team of paralegals was asked to manually search through 10,000 documents, approximately 30,000 pages, for those documents authored by a certain person and pertaining to a key issue in the case. The ensuing manual search required 67 hours to find 15 documents matching the search query. However, the same search performed using a computerized database took 4 seconds and found all 20 documents. Quod est demonstrandum." I don't speak Latin, but I think that means point well made or something effective. There are 3 issues that came up and were of interest in our discussion of process. The first that I want to raise with you involved the question of search terms. One of the questions that we put to plaintiffs was whether you would supply search terms, whether you would request to know the search terms that the producing party used in the search. The near uniform response on behalf of plaintiffs was yes. Supplying search terms is an effective way to narrow the scope of search, to be more specific, to increase the chances that you'll actually get what it is that you're looking for. Some doubts raised as to whether supplying search terms might not make the defendant's road easier, that some things the defendants might know about could go past the boards while limited to the plaintiff's search terms, but that seemed a minor concern in proportion to the desire to be reasonable and to focus on what was really desired. On the defendant's side, the question, though, of whether to respond to a request to know what search terms were used meets with a much more cautious response. The search terms used in discovery clearly are a work product. They are part of the lawyer's judgment about how to go about making a search. And one can certainly say that the search terms one uses reflects one's thinking about a case. And so it's unlikely that a defendant could be forced over the attorney-client work product privilege to produce the listing of search terms. And defendants observed that in paper discovery, it's typically the case that a team of paralegals goes through a ton of documents, and they are effectively given search terms by which to make their search, and that it has not been the practice in the past to turn over search terms and the architecture of search to the other side, but simply to require them to trust the process of the producing party. And yet, where digital discovery is concerned, there is a counter-argument that seems quite powerful, a desire on behalf of defendants to stay out of trouble downstream with respect to searches. Something that can be done if the search architecture, the search strategy, even the search terms are made open and turned over to the requesting party. To the extent that that's done and they're followed and no objection is made to them, it insulates the producing party from problems down the line should some document turn up that's not been produced and should have been included. It gives the producing party a basis for saying it's not our fault. By doing that, giving substantial protection against the possibility of sanction. And so this issue comes out in something of a balance. We asked also the question whether producing parties would be willing to rely on electronic search for the basics of the search process, identifying relevant documents, identifying proprietary information that shouldn't be disclosed, and identifying privileged information that shouldn't be disclosed. For the most part, the hierarchy was just that. For relevance, some willingness to rely on the digital search. For proprietary data, less willingness, but if the data is turned over subject to protective order, at least some sense that there is protection, and with good search technique, some willingness to rely upon it. When it comes to privileged data, much more hesitance. A few of the corporate counsel, perhaps recognizing that cost in doing the human search is really the largest cost element of the discovery process, were willing, if the search techniques are excellent, to rely on a digital search for privileged material, and especially so if there is some agreement with the other side that makes explicit the requirement to turn back any privileged documents without making copies of them that happen to get turned over in the search. On the other hand, defense counsel, producing counsel, were by and large much more cautious with respect to privileged material. First, a skepticism that one could rely on agreements based on the other side's agreement to postpone to any degree objections about privilege. Second, the sense that postponement could only be for a brief time, could not be till trial. That was much too late. By the time you get to trial, you need to know what documents are going in and what not. Trial strategy depends upon it. And third, some worry that courts would actually effectuate agreements about inadvertent disclosure of privilege. The feeling being that courts want to see some reasonable search undertaken to determine privilege, reasonable care taken to make sure that privilege is not breached, and that some courts might consider electronic search not to be sufficiently careful. The foregoing of the human search, an invitation to courts, for courts to say that if disclosures happen, they are advertent rather than inadvertent. And finally, the third issue on which we saw a real conflict was the question of production. It is the case that digital discovery needs to be thought of in two quite separate ways, one for purposes of search and two for purposes of production, and that electronic search may have tremendous advantages, but electronic production is highly problematic. Ask the question of whether you would want to receive the product of discovery in electronic searchable form, what I had called native format, but which may require a more specific description. People on the plaintiff's side, by and large, said yes, absolutely. Larry Johnson from Theos, speaking to the plaintiff's side, said yes, absolutely. Digital evidence is not only the really true original evidence, it's also the best evidence when compared to paper printouts. And most important, digital data is already in a format to be searched easily and duplicated at low cost for use by others, including clients and co-counsel. And then Myron Eagle Evidence Exchange, Myron says, I think that to get data that was electronic, e.g. email, memos, etc., in paper form, is crazy, capitalized crazy. To get those files in TIFF, T-I-F-F, is equally crazy, again, capitalized. You have simply gone backwards. To get digital data in native poses some problems. No Bates numbers, hard to reference, the file that came as an attachment to an email, etc. But clearly, as a plaintiff, this provides me the most useful data. I can search it, print it, search the metadata for earlier drafts, that is, paper files that defendants are willing to provide them in electronic format, is better than paper, so long as there are stable production numbers. Now, with that enthusiasm on the plaintiff's side, we were met by equal resistance, I would say, on the defense side, a real resistance to turning over documents in electronic form. Harry Baumgartner from BASF said, most practitioners today resist turning over documents in native format. To do so simply opens up many cans of worms. For one, it creates potential problems with respect to possible alteration of documents by the adversary in a way that may be difficult to track and expensive to prove. For another, it raises questions of relevance and also questions of what the definition of a document is. Isn't the final product enough? Why is it? Why is it relevant to allow access in every case to metadata that may reveal the who, the what, the when, the where, the why of every single document or piece of data in a production? Ought not there be some special showing before you're required to do so? Think of the potential costs, Harry Baumgarten says, of having to review such information before turning it over. Should we now change the rules such that every thought ever recorded by every individual is now subject to production? I think, says Harry, that is an extraordinary waste of resources and time and would continue the ongoing erosion of Rule 1, which calls for the just, speedy, and expensive determination of every action. And quite similar to Harry, but perhaps a little less flamboyant, Jeff Stewart from Jones Day says, there are troubling issues of the best evidence rule. How do we prevent electronic documents from being altered? Note, says Jeff, this is a symmetrical issue. Plaintiffs could say the same things about defendants, defendants about plaintiffs. And second, he points out, there are logistical issues having to do with affixing and enforcing a uniform system of document control numbers. Otherwise, there are competing document designation systems, which is a major headache in handling a large case. And further, he goes on to suggest that giving documents in native format just helps the other side. It speeds their learning curve. It gives them opportunities to find new theories of cases. It puts the information in a more easily usable form. And so the last step in Jeff Stewart's process, as is true with others on the defense side, having searched documents electronically, having used screen reviews by paralegals, having used databases in order to record the information about the discovery process as it goes along, the last step in the process is to print everything to paper and give it to the other side. So now, as you go back to your discussion groups, if you would, I'd be pleased if you would consider the following questions. How, if one were to try and solve the logistical problems of electronic production, that is, the ability to track documents in such a way that they can be assured authenticity, and how can you track documents just with the process of a consistent and effective numbering system? How can you do these things with electronic production? Is it the case that you can't do them and therefore the defense is the producing party is insulated from the need to produce? Or is it the case that there are ways of doing it? And here, once again, is an opportunity for the requesting party to structure the request in such a way that you ask not only for documents of a particular scope, but you ask for documents to be produced to you in a particular and specifically electronic searchable format. That's a question I'd love to have you address. Now, if you would, please return to discussion groups and let's see what we have to say.
Falling right through my hand. Yeah, I sold the map up to the sky. Falling down all the time. Thank you.
I will, don't worry. I'm not going to go with it right first. But I will be calling for it very shortly. So how are discussions going? It'd be a mistake to cut them off.
Now I will burn before I sing. Wouldn't get too close. Now I will play my treble song in the new sunshine. I was a skinny white singer with no more time. I was approached to throw you in on the new sunshine. Yeah, when I better cover ourselves with it. Better wait here for the night. We can never run out again in the new sunshine. We'll be smoking on the beach, dedicating songs. Wait, I'd like to send them out in the new sunshine.
So let me draw you away one last time. The last question that we had put out during the week dealt with spoliation. Some of you have not yet responded to the web form. Others have, and I encourage you to do so. Spoliation is, to me, a fascinating subject. It is an old, ancient topic. It traces back to the first case in the law school property book that at least I used when I was a student, the case of Amory versus Delamire, of the chimney sweep who found a ring in the chimney with a valuable stone in it and turned it over to his boss, who said if no one claimed it, he'd give it back to the chimney sweep. But when time came for him to give it back, the stone was gone out of the setting. And so the court originated what has come to be the spoliation doctrine by saying that the chimney sweep was due a stone of the finest water. The inference would be that his boss had taken the stone, and given the fact that he had taken it, the damages should be assessed at the maximum in terms of the stone that would fit the setting. This is an inference from purposely suppressed evidence, and it clearly has in it a measure of punishment as part of the sanction. This is a doctrine that, although ancient, in fact had not, as far as I could tell, been much used. I actually wrote a piece about spoliation in the early 90s and could find relatively isolated cases in which willful destruction had resulted in serious, sometimes very serious, consequences up to and including default. But the fact is, they were few and far between. Spoliation was not something that
was driving the discovery process. Electronic discovery, I think, has changed that. So much of electronic discovery deals with a process that is distributed and is churning over with turnover, that the problem of destruction of documents becomes a serious and challenging problem that companies confront. Of all of the various sanctions of spoliation that are possible, from the assessment of fees and costs all the way through to default, in my judgment, the most serious sanction in realistic and practical terms is the threat of jury instruction given on the spoliation inference, the statement by a judge to a jury that the jury can entertain an inference that whatever was destroyed would have been to the advantage of the other party. And that brings along with it the permission to that party to raise the question of document destruction with the jury. One case that was remarkable in this respect back approximately 10 years ago was the Kodak Berkey antitrust case. At trial, actually just before the closing argument, the lawyer for Kodak realized that one of his associates had hidden a suitcase full of relevant documents pertaining to one of the witnesses in a closet. And this lawyer came forward to the judge and disclosed the fact of this document suppression. The judge then allowed the opposing counsel to present this question to the jury through stipulation and argument, and the judge backed him up with a spoliation inference. The result was a huge treble damage verdict against Kodak, which was, by the way, subsequently reversed on appeal. We have our own example in the Linen case. Notwithstanding its representation that it would preserve relevant documents, American Home Products subsequently revealed through its counsel that backup tapes continued to be recycled for a period of 4 months in at least one place within the company. The plaintiff's attorney moved for sanctions by reason of the destruction of these backup tapes, and the judge agreed to allow the matter to be brought to the jury's attention and to give the jury an instruction that it could infer that the destroyed documents would have been favorable to the defendants. Look with me now at a little film video clip of what the plaintiff's lawyer, Alex McDonald, was able to do with this in closing argument.
As the evidence has shown that Mary Linen would never have taken the deadly risk of PPH from a diet of pills, nor would any other reasonable person in her position. Now, why did they do it? They did it for profit and they did it for money. Now, I showed you some documents. Let me tell you some two points of conclusion. There's a lot of documents in this case, and you're going to see a lot of documents. That's only the tip of the proverbial iceberg, but there are a lot of documents you're not going to see. There's a lot of documents I haven't gotten to see, my colleagues haven't gotten to see, and Mr. and Mrs. Linen haven't gotten to see, and you're not going to get to see them. And the reason for that is that you will hear in this case that during the course of this case, the impulse for deception and the impulse to not tell all the things that
you
that documents were destroyed, that an order was entered by this court at the very beginning of this case, on May 5th, 1997, the documents were not to be destroyed, they were to be retained, that agreements were reached between the Linen's lawyers and the drug company lawyers, documents would be preserved. And you will find, and it has already been found, that documents were destroyed, and thousands of documents and emails among the people at the company in the time that matters most in this case don't exist. And they don't exist for the simple reason that American Home Products destroyed the documents. And the legal implications of that destruction, you will hear at the end of this case from the judge.
The case settled for a very large amount of money, the largest award to a wrongful death plaintiff in Massachusetts history. And in fact, this spoliation inference that was granted in the Linen case has continued to have effect in the multi-district litigation that is ongoing with FenFen. So this inference, which can be so potentially devastating, and which in its way is very easy for the judge to order, this is not a shifting of costs, which seems to have a mandatory kind of intrusive quality to it. This is simply allowing arguments and giving instruction, and yet the effect can be totally, totally devastating in a case. This inference is grounded in evidence law. It's part of the law that relates to statements of party opponents. It is part of the law that says that if a party opponent acts in a way that's relevant, then that action can be introduced and inferences drawn from it. Here the action is the destruction of documents. But it is a part of the logic of this, at least it would seem so, that the act of destroying evidence must be willful in order for an inference to be drawn from it. Otherwise, where is the state of mind that is effectively guilty on the part of the party opponent? The fact is, however, that although some courts require willfulness as a predicate for awarding a spoliation inference, other courts are not quite so strict with it and will, in some circumstances, allow lesser forms of intent, lesser state of mind to undergird a spoliation inference, forms not merely of negligence, but of more towards gross negligence. There is a second issue that arises with spoliation, and that is, what is the content of what was spoliated? The very fact that the evidence was destroyed will almost necessarily leave in doubt the question of what it was that was destroyed. If we knew precisely, we wouldn't have a problem. And this leads some judges to say, unless we know what's destroyed, we don't know that there has been prejudice created by the defendant's action. These two issues, in fact, connect in a quite pragmatic way. The more clear the willfulness of the destruction, the more the inference follows that what must have been destroyed was relevant. And in the other direction, the less the proof of willfulness, the more one is relying on some form of negligence or gross negligence, the more that an indication of the relevance, the pertinence of what was destroyed, would seem to be required if there is to be an inference. Now, once again, let me ask you to go to the discussion groups. And in this, I want to offer you a kind of final closeout for what we're doing here, and give you instructions that run not only to the discussion group, but to the answering of the final questions that we would like you to do in the web forms that are part of our website. The question that I'd like you to discuss in discussion group is the role of good faith with respect to the spoliation inference. Is good faith a defense to spoliation? Should it be? Is it enough for a plaintiff to prove that there was a responsibility to preserve and there was destruction? Is it also the plaintiff's burden, or should it be, to prove willfulness? And if that's the case, how can the plaintiff do it? How is it possible for a plaintiff to prove willfulness in the typical kind of case that the big companies are most worried about? For the most part, the big companies, at least to my experience, are not so worried about the outright willful destruction. Their worry is that they don't have sufficient control over their information environments to ensure complete satisfactory production. And so some negligent loss is almost inevitable. Their position would seem to have merit, and yet the alternative that they offer, that is, of a clear-cut assertion that good faith is enough, would seem to leave an opening for a sloppy practice being very much to the producing party's benefit. So that's the question. What should the standard be? Now, if you would, and those in the discussion, moderating the discussion groups, I hope will remind you of this. Once you finish discussion of the spoliation issue, I ask you to go back to our main site and go to the left-hand portion of your screen. Those of you who have not responded to question number 6 on the judge's role, please go forward and do so. Ultimately, the big question is this digital discovery environment going to change the role of judges? Are they able to respond to it without significantly having to engage problems that they may or may not be willing to engage? You might also think, when you're considering the change in judges' role, how the digital discovery environment is likely to change the environment for defense lawyers as well. Will the law firms change in some significant way as they contract out more and more digital discovery to experts? Will the actual structure of defense practice change as paralegals may or may not be substituted or find substitution in electronic discovery modes? And last on that front, how is this to change the plaintiff's bar? Is this really an enhancement to the plaintiff's role? It would seem that this digital environment changes the relative balance of power in a way that ultimately will be to the plaintiff's advantage, because it evens the odds between the little guy and the big guy in a way that only the digital environment seems to have the capacity to do. And then finally, if you would, having answered web form number 6, please come back and respond to web form number 7. That is our feedback form. This has been an exciting experience for us, one that I hope signals a change in CLE as well as a change in digital discovery. I look forward to responding to your web forms during the week that's following by email, and to distributing to you some summary materials of what we've done. And I thank you very much for participating. And let me say in conclusion, thank you very much also to those who've been moderating and helping with the technical environment here. So at this point, I'm signing off on video. Thank you very much for having participating. Goodbye and good luck. We'll see you next time.
Knock it down, take it away. We've got work tearing down this place. Take it away, take it away, take it away. Here's a room where they lay away to a complicated night. We were staring at the wall, and she cried and cried and cried. Under our roof, the hell the real rang out and covered up the sound. We built her every wall, and we had to tear it down, knock it down. Take it away. We've got work carrying down this place. Look for a ghost haunted by God left you decay. Knock it down. Take it away. We've got work carrying down this place. Take it away. Take it away. Take it away.
I was lost up on the mountain. I was on an empty beach. I was lost down in the canyon. And now I'm coming home. Will you remember me? Well, I left town with a hardcore band. Get light shining on the beach. Left my money in a Maxwell coffee can down by the cemetery gate. When I walk into your kitchen and I hold your tiny face, mother dear, will you remember me? I was lost upon the mountain. I was on an empty beach. Down in the canyon, I'm coming home. Will you remember me?
that cold night to cry, and you're a good old town. When I walk into your bedroom and I look you in the eyes, sister, dear, you remember me. I was born on the mountain. I'm coming home.